This episode is brought to you by LaFosse Academy, a program dedicated to helping people from diverse backgrounds break into the tech industry. They don't just train you with the skills you need, they help you to land your first role, give you real-world experience and a strong foundation to launch your career in tech. For businesses, the Academy offers a way to build diverse, future-ready teams while creating opportunities for talented individuals who might not have had a traditional route into tech. So, whether you're looking to start a career in tech or you're a business leader ready to build a stronger, more diverse team, speak to LaFosse Academy and take the next step. At Elevate Colour, we're proud to share their mission to level the playing field and create a tech workforce that truly reflects society. Hi everyone, welcome back to Race to the Top with me, Oki Elazu. In today's episode, I'll be speaking to Sam Kasumu, who's a prominent social entrepreneur. We talk about lots of things, including working at Number 10, but not going to any of those parties, being raised in the church and how that helped with the challenges of school, learning to embrace dealing with different types of people and never using race as an excuse. Sam has a really unique experience or set of experiences, which means that he's incredibly insightful as well as being inspirational. I found the conversation enlightening and I think you will too. Let's get into this. So, welcome Sam.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
That's really quite an impressive CV.
You reckon?
Oh, well, yeah, for sure, right? Please tell me, you've been a special advisor to the Prime Minister on civil society. What does that actually even mean?
Yeah, so when I was in Number 10, between 2019 and 2021,
right.
I was a senior special advisor, or SPAD, as we like to call it. And I had
what do you call it?
SPAD.
Yeah, okay.
And I had a cross-cutting role. So essentially, part of my role was around how we engage with different communities and policy areas related to that, like the response to the Windrush scandal, the move of the Social Mobility Commission to the Cabinet Office, public appointments and things like that. And then the other part was civil society. So essentially, when David Cameron came into power in 2010, he came up with this concept, or he led on a concept called the Big Society,
which
was essentially how do you get civil society more involved in dealing with social issues and delivering public services. Didn't quite land well because it was also during a period of austerity, and so part of my job was how do you reimagine the relationship between civil society and the public sector. And so that's building bridges where they were burnt, making sure that there were very strong and meaningful policy directives around things like how we spend dormant assets from insurance firms and the like. And then, of course, we entered a pandemic. So a lot of my job was around how can civil society play a meaningful role in the response to that. Those are the kind of things I was
What does that even mean, civil society?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And so for some people, it means charities, and yet there are about 170,000 charities,
registered
charities in the UK. But it goes a bit further than that. It also means social enterprises, community interest companies, people who volunteer, people who are involved in supporting and building their social infrastructure in an informal or formal way. So it's really quite broad. And the reality is, most of us are probably involved in some semblance of civil society. We just might not put a label on it.
Right. Okay. The fact that it's so nebulous, was it easy to work within? You know, so an organisation is normally very easy to work with when it's really clearly defined.
Mm-hmm.
Well, civil society seems like a much broader, you know, who's in it, who's not in it, and how do you address it? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, and I suppose why there was a special advisor with that as part of their job description was because of that. You know, when you're in the heart of government, everything you do is based on scale, whether that's, you know, how you respond to the defence needs or Home Office, you know, and justice, etc. These are all really big questions that involved many people and a lot of money being spent.
Mm-hmm.
And so with civil society, the challenge was because it didn't necessarily just sit in one place. It was cross-cutting. There's civil society everywhere. You know, yeah. Even in the armed forces, there was civil society that deals with people who may have, you know, been injured in conflict or people who have PTSD, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so because it was so big, there was a need for it to have its own unit, mm-hmm. but then for it to also influence everywhere across the rest of government. So complicated, yeah. but interesting, and a challenge that I definitely embraced.
And let's actually ask a question. What's it like working, being getting to number 10 and working in and around that?
Yeah, I always tell people when I worked in Downing Street, I didn't really reflect much on the fact that I was going through that black door pretty much every day. Yeah. And there were times when I would be reminded. So for example, if I was going to work and a friend or somebody in a WhatsApp group was watching Good Morning Britain, and then they would say, was that Samuel coming into number 10? I'm like, yeah. Okay, fine, that's quite random. Or when my wife would tell me off for wearing trainers that she didn't like to work, and then she'd say, I just saw you on TV, why are you wearing those trainers? Those are the only moments where I really, you know, reflected on the fact that, oh yeah, that's a bit random. People can see me on TV as I go into work. But more often than not, I was just mainly focused on the mission. And to be honest with you, it was only after I'd left that I was like, okay, wow, that was probably a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
I don't have any pictures of me, for example, outside of number 10 Downing Street.
None at all.
No, because I didn't go in there as a tourist.
Yeah.
I was going to work, and it was only recently that I was like, hold on, that's a bit weird. Like it was a huge privilege for you to work through that black door. And you never took any time to really pause and reflect. Having said that, there wasn't really a lot of time to do that, because when I went in, it was in summer of 2019, there was challenges around Brexit, and then we had an election that we fought, and I was part of the manifesto team, etc. We then returned, I went on holiday, I came back, we were in a pandemic.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much time for me to be like, hey, let me just really pause and reflect on just where I am, and you know, if someone like me doesn't usually end up in a place like that.
I know. But I won't even ask you about the parties, right? Because I don't want you to.
No, you can ask. It's fine. I was not at any parties.
I can categorically say that I was so definitely not at any parties.
Simple answer.
And all my WhatsApps have disappeared.
not all, but yeah, you got to keep a few, because yeah, you've got to be able to protect yourself from future threats and future attacks.
So exactly.
Some of those messages are still there.
On a serious note, though. Being a young black guy with dreads going to number 10, there's not a lot of you people like you going in. Did you ever feel different, or how was your sense of belonging in that environment?
I mean, to be fair, I didn't have locks at the time.
All right, okay.
Or was I probably would have stood out even more.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it would have happened even?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go into Downing Street because I was part of the Vote Leave set with Dominic Cummings, Lee Kane and co. And I wasn't a legacy hire. So I wasn't a guy that, I mean, I was on an advisory board for Theresa May, but I didn't work for Boris Johnson when he was Mayor of London. I didn't work full time in Downing Street before. And those were the types of people that, you know, went in when I was there. I was brought in because there were very few people that could do the job that was needed. There was very few people who had an understanding of civil society, that whose science was being able to reach different communities in different ways, and human behavior, and who also had a particular lens, political mm-hmm. lens. In fact, I would argue that in many respects, certainly I was the most senior or experienced person that could tick those boxes.
Right.
And so I was one of the very few people that probably ended up there based on merit. and in terms of my experience, you know, there were some times perhaps when, you know, I was conscious of my ethnicity in a way that maybe was challenging. But more often than not, I was there, I was given a political role, and my job was to try my best to deliver. And that was my focus.
Yeah, yeah. And you can be very focused on that when it's clear what you're there to do.
Yeah. And also a place like Downing Street, when I was there, maybe 150, 180 people working in that small building, about 30 to 40 were special advisors, and then they were split into different teams, etc. And so not many people holding a lot of power means that if you're one of those few individuals, you don't have time to think about your own experience. You have to focus on the politics, on the power dynamics, on being able to push your agenda, whilst also being able to build trust, to be empowered to do things and ensuring that, you know, your voice carries weight. And so most of my focus was on, you know, how I could make sure I could be as impactful as possible. And also obviously having to learn very quickly from people who perhaps had a head start because of their own social experiences and backgrounds.
All right. So, okay. Yeah. And then we'll come back to that in a minute when we kind of go a bit more into the work and the career stuff. But we always like to start at, or sort of start, at the beginning, really. And so I know, you know, we record in the Borough of Barnet, and you're from around here, you're a Londoner.
Yeah.
Born and bred, I think it's fair to say. Yeah,
Barnet, best place in the world.
Yeah, you know. But from Nigerian parentage, Yoruba parentage. So can you tell me what it was like growing up in Barnet, London?
Yeah, I mean, we moved around quite a bit. When I was born, I'm told my family lived in Leytonstone.
Okay.
And then...
Well, East Ended.
Yeah. And then my earliest memories are of living in East Dulwich in South London in a council estate. And I remember being a bit of a naughty kid. I was actually expelled from nursery, believe it or not.
You got expelled from nursery?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what happened, but, you know, I'm alleged to have assaulted some adults.
All right. Way. As a five-year-old?
Probably a three-year-old, three or four-year-old. Wow,
that's going something.
Well,
I've heard a lot of people about excluded, but I'm not sure I've ever heard
of it. Yeah, I was told not, he shouldn't start school until he's five.
Right.
And so apparently that's what, that's what they said. And then... And we moved around a lot. We spent a bit of time in Nigeria for like 6 or 7 months, which I can remember. Yeah, I went to a school called Tender Touch.
All right.
And as you can imagine, for naughty kids, it wasn't the easiest of experiences.
There wasn't much Tender Touch there.
Well, it depends how you define tender.
In Lagos?
Yeah, Lagos, yeah. Okay. And then we came back, and I was probably six, seven. And then from that moment until I left my house, I lived basically in and around the Borough of Barnet. Mm-hmm. At seven, that's when my father left. So five siblings, single parent at home. It was a challenge.
Mm.
But I suppose those are the experiences that really shaped who I am today.
So your dad left the home when you were seven?
Yeah, seven.
You didn't see much after that?
No.
All right.
Okay. No. He then went to live abroad for a significant period of that time.
Right. Of your five siblings, were you?
I was number four.
Oh, all right, near the bottom.
So yeah, relegation zone. No power.
No power. There's no power at number four.
Yeah.
All right. But what was it like? I mean, in terms of growing up and sort of role modeling and that sort of thing in that sort of scenario. Was it your older siblings?
To an extent, I think my siblings would probably say that I'm the most quiet.
Okay.
So the introvert in a family of extroverts, folks who are from, you know, descendants of the Yoruba tribe, very loud, very colourful, very expressive. And then you've got this introvert that's like not quite in the middle, but it's, you know, towards the bottom of the rung. So that was, I suppose, interesting. But then by the time I was like 12 or 13, we started to go to church regularly. So my social circle were folks around my age.
Okay.
And we were basically, you know, going to church a few days a week. And that helped in terms of the role modeling, because you could see at least the semblance of a highly functioning, well-structured family at the front, especially in black majority churches, you know what that's like.
And then
we're not going to comment on whether or not, you know, the image is aligned with the reality. But nonetheless, as a young person, seeing that was interesting. And then, of course, like in the evangelical expression, you're also exposed to a lot of imagery of being someone that reaches for the sky. You know, you're taught that all things are possible. You're taught to write the vision, make it plain so that those who see it can run with it.
Yeah.
And so actually there was this, I suppose, a juxtaposition of a home that was not necessarily fully functional and a life that perhaps could have been more ideal for someone my yeah. age, particularly a young man or male. And then on the other side, you turn up every Sunday and maybe a Wednesday, maybe even a Friday, and hanging out with a bunch of people around your age. So at least there was a sense of community, and you were constantly being told to make sure that your life was one of public service mm-hmm. and for you to be ambitious for the right types of things. So I think those are the two things that probably impacted or shaped much of who I am and what I do.
Yeah, it's quite funny, isn't it? When you talked, so my family's very religious too, and people say, oh, you go to church. I'm like, yeah, that's the Sunday. Mm. And then on, you know, we go to visit the Reverend's house some days, and then we go on a Wednesday. I'm like, oh my God. Mm. Oh, no pun intended. That's a lot, mm-hmm. you know, and it's amazing when you look back. I hadn't thought to it just now how much it's intertwined in your life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think one of the things that perhaps most of us are missing out on today is that sense of consistency around our social interactions with like human beings. Like,
yeah,
you know, people don't go to the pubs every day anymore, and I don't know if they ever did, but yeah. let's assume they went quite regularly. Yeah, yeah. I was a district councillor, and one of my former councillor colleagues he was talking about his wife, and I said, oh, where did you meet her? And he said, well, we went to what did he call this there was a social club mm-hmm. that they all used to go to many years ago, and yeah. that's where he met his wife. And things like that don't really happen as much. And for people like, I guess, us, the church was essentially the main social circle.
Yeah, yeah.
This is where you had friends that you met regularly, intentionally, and you were invested in whatever that social circle was trying to do and achieve. And yeah, a lot of that is missing, and that's left a large gap in, I guess, a lot of the richness that we need to have as human beings.
Yeah, yeah. So how did that work out with school? Because obviously you've got your home, you've got your church, but obviously you're at school. How did school work for you?
I was still very naughty at school.
All this religious intervention didn't help you not but being naughty
helped,
at school.
It helped me not to go too far.
All right, okay.
But it didn't change the things that made me who I am. And to be fair, in many respects, some would argue that I still haven't changed.
All right.
I still am quite troublesome.
Well, but, hopefully in a positive way.
Well, yeah, again, it depends on who you are.
So, yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, no, it probably helped me not to go too far. So I had, you know, as you can imagine, a young man in London who doesn't have a lot of parent supervision, the likelihood of you being engaged in, you know, adverse behaviour is quite heightened.
Yeah.
And so I had friends who had similar experiences to me who maybe I would see when we were bunking off school, which is obviously not a good thing to do, or we were both excluded. But then they went into, you know, being involved in taking drugs. I've never taken any kind of drug in my life, and I think part of that is because of
religion,
your
church.
And so, yeah, it played a role in perhaps ensuring I never crossed the line.
Yeah.
And it probably did play a role in shaping my worldview.
Yeah.
So I would say they're probably the strongest things, but it didn't completely change my behaviors. I was not a perfect young person by any stretch of imagination.
Or student. So did you get excluded at all?
Yeah, in secondary school, 3 times, yeah.
Oh, right, okay, fine.
Yeah. So I was consistent.
Oh, yeah, sounds like it. You know, but always going back to a different school or a new school, or you were chopping and changing?
Different school. There was in year 9 in particular, that was quite an interesting moment because I went to 3 schools within 2.5 terms.
Wow.
And it was only when it dawned on me that, oh my goodness, there's 2.5 terms. Like, you just probably need to try and, like, behave yourself.
Yeah.
That was a real turning point. But also the school I ended up in, East Barnet School, was very peculiar because I started at that school at the same time as another young black guy, and I remember sitting in the reception and the school speaking to the previous school that I was coming from, and I don't know why I was in the room or whatever whilst they were talking to the previous school, and I remember someone at the previous school saying, well, he's going to be a handful, he's this, he's that, and the person on the phone saying, well, don't worry, we think we'll be fine with him, and we have very clear values, and you know, and we'll be just fine. And I was thinking, why the hell are they trying to say that I'll be fine when actually
I'm not?
Yeah, well,
I don't
have a track record.
I break things.
And I remember when I walked through that school on that day, East Barnet School, The very first thing I saw was this slogan, and it said, "I want to learn." And then I walked through the school. I was walking through the school, and I noticed that all the kids were like in the classroom. Like, and I was like, "What is going on here?" And it was like silence. And I thought to myself, "I'm not going to survive here," because the other schools I was in were not very good, and I just, you know, was part of
the mayhem.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so now I'm in a school where everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people are very well behaved. How on earth am I going to survive this? But you know, the school and the head teacher, they really did put in the shift, and they were patient with me. And if it wasn't for that school, I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today.
I can imagine this. It's really interesting, because there's probably a little bit about structure and values, and that somehow someone who shouldn't have fitted into the few people thought wouldn't fit into a school does, right? Because there's something around the values of the school or the education that must have worked for you, must have resonated for you, or the way you were treated, or your sense of belonging.
Yeah, I mean, just for the most of that, I was not perfectly behaved at any point. But I think they could see that I was someone that had the potential to achieve, you know, good things academically, and I think that they also felt like, because the school was not very diverse, that there was a vested interest in trying to understand how to ensure someone like me can have a productive experience in a school like that. As I said, me and another kid starting on the same day, we were both black, and we basically doubled the black population in that year school. It was that strange.
And how did that feel for you, being an ethnic minority and very much being a black kid in a London school? Yes, you're going to be a minority, but a lot of schools you're not. Mm-hmm. So you were in this school. How did that make you feel, and how do you think that shaped you?
In terms of how it made me feel, I mean, I'd grown up in and around Barnet, which back then was not the most diverse borough in London.
Okay.
It's changed a lot now, but certainly back then it wasn't. So I don't think I particularly felt a way. But what it has done is it's allowed me to be able to engage with different people from different backgrounds in different ways, and to feel comfortable in any space, whether that's political, business, or a faith group, or amongst people from the same or different ethnic backgrounds. I don't feel uncomfortable, and I suppose that's partly why that is my science, because you know, it's just something I'm very comfortable doing.
Yeah, and so the education system kind of almost worked out for you in a weird way, but not really. I mean, did you go straight from school to work, or?
No, I went to university.
Okay, so through all of this, and this isn't, you're not the first person that I've had here who's talked about this, I wouldn't call it necessarily chaotic, but very, very changeable journey, but still manages to move into higher education. What drove you to that? What made you want to do that? Because, you know, as you're telling the story, you're thinking, he's probably not going to end up at university. And you do. So what compelled you to do that and achieve that?
So, like, you know, when you're from a Nigerian household, it's the only option. It doesn't really matter. You're going to get there, no matter
There's certainly an expectation.
Yeah, no matter how scenic the route is, your final destination is a university.
Yeah.
So there was that. I think... No, I could have gone to a better university. I had the A-levels to do that. And so not having the influence of, like, my father, who's got a PhD and he's very academic, probably meant that I didn't go as far as I could have within academia. But I think the overall impact of going to East Barnet School was that I was able to still navigate the education system despite all of the behavioural challenges that I had. And then when I got to university, I was able to, I guess, push on in some respects.
Well, your own person, then it's really down to you, not anyone else.
Yeah, no one's policing.
You're not fighting a system. You're really fighting yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so exactly. I suppose that once you get there, then that kind of works itself out. And how much of a role did race play in your early development, school and university? Was it something you were conscious of, or pushing against, or not conscious of it at all?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Let's say, you know, growing up in a black majority church, I was always around people that looked like me, but also living in Barnet, I was in a village, East Barnet Village specifically. Mm. I was conscious of the fact that I was not around, or not living around, or even going to school with people who look like me. But I don't think it had as huge an impact on my life as perhaps it has on some other people.
Yeah.
Up until the time when I got to university. But when I got to university, that's probably where things got a bit more interesting, because right. not many people from my area went to my university.
Yeah.
And
where did you go?
I went to Brunel.
Okay.
And then...
you're doing engineering?
No, but no. Yeah, but it's usually the case.
Yeah.
But accounting, funnily enough. And then, so I get there and not many people from Barnet are at Brunel. And then also the only other person from Barnet that I knew, well, there's two, but one was a guy called Sam, mm-hmm. who was white. And so when we used to hang around with each other, people used to say, well, white Sam. Yeah. But they wouldn't say black Sam for some reason. I wonder why. But yeah, they used to call him white Sam. And so that's what they used to call him. But I get to there and actually, yeah, the only person I'm relatively close to from my area is a white guy. Mm. And because we were from the same school, we were very cool with each other, yeah. and we were good, great friends. But then most of the African Caribbeans at the university were from South London.
Yeah.
And they had their strong social circles, and actually their behaviours were maybe slightly different from to what someone from Barnet was kind of used to. Mm-hmm. And so I get to university where, in many respects, I'm actually an outsider because, I'm black, but from Barnet. So that's quite interesting. And then in my second year, I became the president of the African Caribbean Society,
okay.
which at the time was the largest in the UK. Oh, wow. 500 members.
Right.
And so there's this guy who's not from a similar background to many of the African Caribbeans on the campus. All of a sudden is the captain.
Yeah.
was interesting. And that's probably when I started getting exposed to things like race relations and politics and things like that. But yeah, but as growing up, it was less of a thing that I focused on, to be honest.
Wow. I always think about this. I never joined the Afro-Caribbean Society because I'm not sure I saw the benefit for myself, because I was just very much single-minded. How useful do you think things like, because obviously that now spreads into most companies now have employee resource groups and all of these sort of things. Mm. How useful do you think that is? Like organizational sort of setting up these sort of groups of what they see as like-minded people, but only just the same skin people, really. It doesn't mean they're like-minded.
No. I think... I tell people you need to have different types of social networks, mm-hmm. for you to progress in any part of life, because actually even if you've got one mentor, it's very unlikely that one person is going to be able to speak to every single facet of your personal life,
yep.
or personal or professional life. So for example, someone who is a CEO who's gotten to the top of their sector or what have you, doesn't necessarily mean they're a good husband or wife.
No.
Doesn't necessarily mean they're a good parent. And doesn't necessarily mean they have a work-life balance or whatever.
But it means they're neither of those three.
Yeah, well, more often than not, right? And so actually you kind of need to learn and embrace different types of people.
Yeah.
And so with a network like an African Caribbean Society or a multicultural network or whatever you want to call it, there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself. But if that's the only place that you get your sense of connection from, or value from, or education from, then that becomes problematic.
Yeah.
We're all multifaceted. Like I'm from Barnet. I love to connect with people who also grew up in Barnet, and so we can both talk about how great the borough is. But also I have Nigerian heritage. Also I'm a Black Brit. But also there are many other things that make me who I am. And so being able to break that down and ensure that actually you can embrace different parts of identity and also engage with people that have completely different experiences to your own is how you become richer. So yeah. In and of itself, not a bad thing, but if that's the only place you go for all those things that you want, then that's probably a problem.
Yeah, I think so. I'm still sort of formulating my views on it, but certainly, yes, it helps to have shared experiences and shared voices. But, you know, the whole thing is supposed to be about diversity. And in some ways, they create less diversity by saying, here's a group that you can hang out with. And if you go to work, you only hang out with the people that look like you. And then that, even though they're created in the name of diversity, often they don't encourage diversity.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because there's this whole debate around things like, you know, safe spaces and, you know, blackout Thursdays or whatever, where you create opportunities for people only with same identity as yourself to engage in discussions and what have you. I think the sociologists say that it is very natural for us to gravitate towards people who are like us. And so we all have to be very conscious of that and make sure that in doing so, we don't exclude others.
Mm-hmm.
And also in doing so, we do it in a way that is useful for everybody. And so, for example, if you have a multicultural network, well, how are you using it to educate and inspire people and to show people more about what it means to be part of said culture?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. But if it's just an opportunity for you to have close circle conversations or for you to just stick with the people who you think are most similar to yourself, then that's definitely problematic.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely something that I'm thinking long and hard about. Quickly back to you going out, because I'm always really intrigued about people's relationship with their parents, or in your case, probably your mother, but it could still be your dad. When you look back, what did they tell you, or what are you thankful that they told you or advised you as when you were growing up?
Yeah, probably more so my mother. I think the one thing she was very passionate about was education, as you can imagine, and making sure that no matter what, you pushed on and you achieved good things. Also, my mother was very, is still, to be fair, very passionate about us staying indoors. And, you know, one of the reasons why I didn't get into as much trouble as I probably could have was because when she was around, nobody was going out.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my friends who probably shouldn't have been my friends at the time would come to my house, spend a little bit at my house. We'd all be playing PlayStation at my house because I wasn't going to go out. And, you know, the one or two times when I did go out with said individuals, I kind of did regret it.
Yeah.
I was like, gosh. You know, I found myself in the middle of some trouble here, and someone like me shouldn't really be in a position like that. So I think those are the two things that I'm very grateful to her for.
Oh, there's definitely I laugh because my mum used to be like, I'm like, well, my friends are going out. She go, where? I'm like, they're just going to hang out in the corner. She's like, nothing good can ever come from you.
Yeah.
Nothing good can ever come from you hanging out with them on the corner. So basically, stay in and watch television. I love television. I think that's where my love for television comes from, staying in and watching lots of it.
Yeah.
You know, so no, I can, and again, it's a very African thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, that just stay out of trouble,
yeah.
you know, because that's effectively what she's saying. She's not saying stay in, she's like, stay out of trouble.
Yeah. Like, we've got no money. Where you go? You're not going to cinema. So.
Don't put yourself in situations where trouble can find you.
Literally.
Just stay out of it and you'll kind of be okay. She didn't say much about you and your race and how you'd have to work harder or not work harder or anything like that. That was...
Not consciously,
no.
And well, not in a way that was ever memorable. And perhaps part of that was her not wanting us to feel like we had an excuse.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, although she may have thought about it, and I'm sure she did. Mm. It wasn't something that she wanted to be part of how we thought about our lives. To be honest.
Yeah. No. I think that's not using race as an excuse. Is something certainly I talk to my kids about, you know, just focus on what you need to do and being the best you can be at being it, and don't play that as a card where you didn't get it. May well be, but don't use that as an excuse.
Yeah, I mean, there are many barriers that we all face in our lives. Some people have more barriers than others, and some barriers are more visible than others. But I suppose ultimately, the individual that is most responsible for their lives is yourself.
Yeah.
And so there is always a question, to what extent should you focus your energies on the barriers?
Yeah.
Or pointing at the barriers, and to what extent should you spend time overcoming those barriers? And there's a fine balance because, of course, you know, you can't, the thing about injustice is, I know it was Martin Luther King who once said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Yeah.
And so there is a need to call things out, to challenge things, but that must also be balanced with the reality, which is that the more successful you are, the more permission you give others to succeed. And so that's, I think that's the challenge that many people face, you know, striking that balance.
You know, I think you're right. So you finish at Brunel, you go to work. What was your first proper job and how did you get it?
So I usually tell people, like, I've only ever had one real job, and that was like working for the Prime Minister.
Yeah. But that's quite nice. I've only had one job and it was working for the PM. Where'd you go from there?
Yeah. So I was after being the president of my ACS, African Caribbean Society. During that time, I wanted to do an event on my campus to bring universities together, and the student union was basically blocking me. And I was just, you know, relatively arrogant 19-year-old. And I was like, this is not good. I'm very angry now. I'm just going to run.
The event for the Afro-Caribbean Society?
Yeah, but a national event. I wanted to do it on my
campus. Oh, wow, national event.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I still did it. But at the time, they were, creating some barriers.
Right.
And so I was like, I'm just going to run this. So I ran to be the VP of my student union. I was the first to get 1,000 votes for a contested seat. And then part of that time, I'd set up a first social enterprise, helping to get students jobs, students from underrepresented backgrounds. So when I left university, I just continued to run that. And then I worked in Westminster for a bit in the House of Parliament, helping post 2010 to support what could happen in the next election. But beyond that, I've always just worked basically for myself. Either helping to set up or setting up and growing social-led, social mission organisations.
So, which I think is amazing, but requires some drive and entrepreneurial spirit, right? So where did you get that from? Not a lot of people just say, I just started this, or I'm going to run that event, or where's this sort of energy and belief come from?
Oh, it's a good question. I mean, both my parents have been involved in business. So I suppose seeing that probably was part of the reason why I've done that kind of work. But also, I'm driven by mission. Mm-hmm. And the challenge for me is that is what motivates me primarily. So I remember when I was leaving university, one of the largest partners we had of this social enterprise helped set up was Barcap Capital.
All right.
And so I remember the lady at Barcap saying, oh, when you leave, just come work for us. Because, right, you know, this guy, he'd been a president of the largest society in the country. He'd been a VP of a union, sat on a board as a 19-year-old of a £2.1 million organization, and also the whole university overseeing their strategic plan. And he'd done all this stuff, was clearly entrepreneurial, done all these things that, you know, students usually do if they want to get a job.
Yeah, yeah.
At the end. And I was just like, no, I remember going to Canary Wharf and going to an insight day, and then, you know, coming out of the bank, looking at all these nice black cars that the bankers had waiting for them, the senior ones. Hmm. And then looking up and then saying to myself, yeah, no, this is not for me. So I've never really been driven by money, never really been driven by maybe personal self-actualization. Mm-hmm. It's always been about the public service. And so for me, the focus has always been, okay, what impact can I make? Mm-hmm. And that's probably why more often than not, I've kind of felt like, there are gaps and I wanted to find ways to create solutions.
So basically, the money has never been held in the interest for you, and the status hasn't either, but doing the right thing for the right people has.
Yeah, I'm ambitious, but I'm ambitious for impact. And so...
Is that ambitious for change? Because most people who are ambitious are normally ambitious for status or money, or mm-hmm. both, normally, a position. But your ambition is social good and impact.
Yeah. So you know, what motivates me is when I think, gosh, I can really do something quite unique here, or there is a huge gap, mm-hmm. you know, in a commercial sense, people say a gap in the market.
Gap in the market, yeah.
Where actually, if I step into that, I can really make a difference. So when I was at university, I noticed that a lot of the students on my campus were not getting jobs and internships, and they were working really hard. And then, you know, a bit of research, and we found out that most of the major graduate employers were only targeting 7 universities, so not even the whole of Russell Group. And their argument is their team couldn't reach 120 universities. Yeah. And so they always got good students from X, Y, and Z universities. So that's just what they did. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to create a network to bridge that gap and say, look, in a very efficient way, I can get more people from different backgrounds to be able to navigate your recruitment system, and I can set up schemes and stuff that won't be too taxing on you from a resource perspective, but actually would help you to achieve a broader mission. So that's why I did that. And then when I left my first job in the House of Commons, was because Lord Young, the late Lord Young, had set up this fund called the Startup Loans Fund, and it was £120 million because people from underrepresented backgrounds were struggling to get access to capital. Mm-hmm. But then they had only lent to 60 people. And so I was like, well, actually, I can create something to really help to scale how many people they were reaching. I spent 5 years, supported over 6,000 entrepreneurial startups, and that was a really fascinating experience. Mm. And of course, with Inclusive Boards, similar story. I was just like, well, actually, you know, there are fantastic people like yourself, all the experience, tick all the boxes. Why are you not being given opportunities to be on various boards? Well, actually, I could create something that helps to bridge that gap. So there have always been moments where I've identified challenges, and either I have set up stuff, or I've helped to grow and scale organizations that I'm not directly involved in. And you know, in the next chapter of my life, this again something I'm really passionate about: global human capital. Mm-hmm. Movement of people, etc. Yep. And I see that as a really important and big challenge, the biggest challenge of our time. And I feel like I can lend my hand to that. And so that's, you know, my next focus. It's just how I'm wired, I suppose.
And so what is, sorry, that's admirable and brilliant. And if you were making, you'd be probably be a gazillionaire by now. But your impact's in something different. What's your superpower in making all this happen? You must have one. Is it relationship building? Is it understanding and marketing the gaps? Is it partnering? What's the thing that Sam does better than anyone else?
I mean, if you were to ask people, I don't know what their answer would be, but
let's ask you.
But I'm very good at joining dots. Mm-hmm. And so I think the consistent thread through most of the things, well, all of the things I do, is saying, well, here is a group of individuals that perhaps don't have access or don't feel like they have choice. So in the world of politics, my science has been able to reach groups and communities that perhaps might not necessarily feel like they can vote a certain way or are less likely to engage with certain, you know, forms of political discourse, right? So you have said group, and then you have the opportunity. And so my science has been able to identify the opportunity and the groups that are maybe excluded or less likely to engage, or people might define as hard to reach, and bridging that gap, essentially. That's my core skill, and then that can be expressed in different iterations and different contexts, different challenges, etc.
Okay, that's good. I suppose the angle I was kind of coming at that with was also around being an entrepreneur of any type is a lot about resilience, mm-hmm. and the ability to push through setbacks, disappointments. Is that something that you must have, because people must say no all the time to stuff that you can't go to them with? How do you get over and deal with setbacks?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose people probably say no to me less because I have like sales teams and stuff.
Less now, but when you start.
Well, as in like, I have like folks who their job is to like, I don't know, generate business. So they're the ones who probably hear no more than I do, to be fair.
But even when you start an idea,
you
say, I'm going to do this, people go, yeah, whatever, or can you be a partner, or will you fund us? You still get a lot of no's.
Yeah,
And setbacks.
I think it's a good question. For me, you need to be resilient to set up any type of organization or what have you. And once you have a clarity of mission or vision, or both, then the next thing is to justify the reason for your existence. So I'm very passionate about research underpinning everything that we do. And then I suppose then you have to find ways to create that value. I used to tell people, you know, if you have a product and nobody wants to buy it, who needs to change?
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a question that is fairly subjective, and there is no right or wrong answer, mm-hmm. because sometimes you have to create the demand.
Yeah.
You know, lots of people are signing up to gyms this month.
Yep.
You know, we have seen an explosion of in terms of the numbers of gyms all over the country. But, you know, 10, 20 years ago, people were not as passionate about fitness as they are now.
Mm.
So, you know, what changed is public knowledge, public discourse, and people really driving forward the agenda of saying, you know, we all need to live a much more healthier life. And so actually who changed? The public changed, not the gym owners,
yeah,
to a large extent. They changed in terms of their models
they're quite
slightly cheaper now,
yeah,
et cetera. And so sometimes it's the market that needs to change.
Mm-hmm.
But also sometimes it's you that has to adapt or change your product. And sometimes it's a bit of both. And so I don't know if I would say, for me, there's a huge focus on resilience, maybe because of how I've grown up, I've always been relatively resilient. But I suppose there's probably more of a focus on understanding your market, understanding where you can adapt, and understanding where actually the challenge might be that, you know, your product is not something that people are willing to buy, or your price point isn't where people are at. But ultimately, just the dynamism, being able to be agile, dynamic, change as quickly as possible to be able to get to a point where you can get market share if it exists. But also there are times in business and in life where there just simply isn't a market, or people simply are not going to buy what you have to sell. And being honest enough to appreciate or recognize that is also a bit of an important skill to have too.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting take on resilience actually, because it sounds to me like you clearly are a problem solver. You said yourself you look for gaps and try and find things to fill it. And if you're a problem solver, failure isn't failure. It's a problem to fix.
Mm-hmm.
This is I'm sort of trying to sort of surmise what you've just said, which is, you know, so something hasn't worked is a failure, whatever. But it's because maybe the market's not ready, or the product's not ready, or whatever. It's just an opportunity to learn,
yeah,
rather than a failure.
Yeah, I would say so. And also, you know, people look at entrepreneurs who are extremely successful and have really big brands, and they don't necessarily always recognize the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a lot of those entrepreneurs, there were many times where they had ideas that didn't quite work.
Oh, all of them.
Well, there you go. Mm. And then also sometimes people have the luxury of capital, which essentially means that they're able to have the room to adapt, mm-hmm, and to fail. So, you know, what is the difference between a tech company that has raised X million and a company that hasn't raised anything and is bootstrapping in the grand scheme of things,
yeah,
more often than not, is the room to fail or try things. And,
yeah,
and you know, why is it that Tesco's hasn't gone bust, but, you know, X business has? Well, Tesco has really deep pockets. So when things aren't going quite right, they're able to remove their CEO or their chair, bring someone else in and give them some room to adapt and change. You know, John Lewis right now is benefiting from a lot of the work of Sharon White, Dame Sharon White, but actually Dame Sharon White's had to do a lot of really tough things, but she also had enough breathing space around the capital for her to do things that have laid really new interesting new foundations. Same with M&S, etc.
Yeah,
and so yeah, the difference very often is the room to fail, and not necessarily the failure in and of itself.
Yeah, yeah, no, I get that. And in terms of being a social entrepreneur, what role has race played in that? Is it open doors, or is it created issues, or both?
I would say in my political career, I think my race has probably been quite significant in allowing me to to go as far as I have, mm-hmm. In the sense that, you know, have a slightly different political lens to people that typically look like me and mm-hmm. in public. Also had a set of skills and experiences linked to my background that made me quite, still makes me quite unique.
Mm-hmm.
In business, I would say it's probably been less material, in the sense that, less material in the sense that I don't think my race has meant that I've gone further.
Yeah.
Maybe there are some barriers linked to my race or my socioeconomic background around things like, you know, how you raise finance. You know, if I had a father who was a former VP at a BP and had a bunch of mates who were like him, and then when I had my first business and I was looking to raise capital, it would have been a slightly easier experience because I would have been able to have a real friends and family round, etc. So I think there are barriers that maybe would have that maybe has meant that my journey has been slightly more challenging, I would say that.
But you haven't encountered, because what's interesting for you is because you've not really had that many real jobs. You've been doing on your own. Your own power, you know, you're not necessarily waiting for an organization to promote you through, mm-hmm. you know, as we talked about, you know, getting to directors or NEDs, or where you're very dependent on the organizational structure to support and promote you.
Yeah.
You know, so you probably had less of that interaction than many other people say that I would have had.
Yeah, I have a really high locus of control. You know, I'm uncomfortable with the idea of my destiny being in the hands of other people.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, in the world we live in today, that is not necessarily an easy position to take. I've had a road less traveled, which has meant that actually very, very often people haven't necessarily had the opportunity to create barriers. Having said that, and actually on reflection, there are times when, you know, we've pitched for work and there is a feeling that, well, okay, that senior director clearly had some issues.
Yeah.
and you know we might not be able to, you know, evidence it in a way that makes an impact here because they are the decision maker.
Yeah.
But clearly there's an issue there. And there are too many individuals like that who still hold a lot of power, of course. But, you know, for every one of an individual like that, there was at least another who's willing to focus on the things that matter.
And to broaden out on that, what role has mentorship and sponsorship played for you in advancing your career? Because one of the things that we talk about in our business that people need to understand, this whole idea of networking and navigating organizations.
Mm-hmm.
What role has that played for you?
Yeah, certainly in my younger years, huge, huge role. I think because of the journey I went on, I was exposed or have been exposed to really senior people very early on.
Yeah.
So I had a mentor who was a politician. He was a member for Central Bedfordshire, Andrew Salu, and he was really impactful in helping me to navigate the political space as a young black guy who had no family member, relative, anyone I knew who had also taken a similar route. And then in business, because of the nature of my work, I was exposed to very senior corporates very often, very, very early. So my first mentor was the people director at Barclays,
mm-hmm.
Which obviously is a huge job. Scottish lady called Catherine, who was very patient at teaching me things that I wouldn't learn anywhere mm-hmm. else. And then, you know, David Tyler, who's chairman of Sainsbury's and is chair of the Sir John Parker Review.
Yep.
He has been someone over the years that has really been good at helping me to understand, you know, business strategy and growth. And so I think my work has probably exposed me to people that, you know, in a relatively more normal life, I probably wouldn't have been exposed to.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
You know, not many people know who David Tyler is, let alone have been exposed to his knowledge and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's one of those things you would advise people to find a mentor or a sponsor in their early years?
Yeah, as soon as possible. But I always tell people that if you want a mentor, the focus cannot just be about what you can take from someone.
Yes.
When you approach a mentor, it needs to feel like it's a win-win. You know, this is the value I can add. And and actually, you know, I mentioned Catherine at Barclays. I was the one of her references for her first board position on a FTSE board.
Right.
And also, I placed on a board.
All right, wow.
And so it was a relationship that wasn't one dimensional. I think she always felt like she got out a lot from also speaking with someone like me.
Yeah.
And so you kind of need to be quiet enough to understand how you can add value to a mentor, because that's what sustains a relationship. A relationship where it's always take, doesn't last the test of time.
Yeah.
But a relationship where people can remember that this person also added value. And actually, adding value doesn't necessarily mean getting someone a job or what have you. It could mean just being a source of joy or being a good listener.
Yeah.
There are different ways that you can add value to somebody's life.
Yeah.
And for them then to feel like, actually, you're the type of person I want to see again in 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And there are other things like making sure you actually action the things that you had discussed.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because there's nothing worse than having a mentee that does not make progress.
Yeah.
You know, especially if you are looking at someone who's quite senior, whose time is not... it's finite. Free time is finite, and for them to sit down with you for an hour, and then in 3 months' time you're in exactly the same place, you know, that hour is worth quite a lot to them, right?
Yeah.
They could have been at home with their family, or they could have been focused on their work, and so you have to be someone that is seen as constantly making progress.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I always say that for me, it's less about the mentor with a mentor-mentee relationship. In terms of how it's sustained, it's all about how the mentee shows that it's a relationship that has value.
Yeah, well, that's really great advice. That's really great advice. So just pulling us around to societal issues, I talk a lot about institutional racism. I'm really interested in your perspective on this generally from what you've done, seeing as you've not really been in organizations, but you've worked in with the government and been in social enterprises. I think if we assume that institutional racism properly exists, well, do you think it does? And if it does, how do you think we can try and change it? You know, talking about gaps in the market, you know, what's your view?
Yeah, I mean, it's a subject that obviously I've had to engage with very much so, particularly in my political life. I think, according to Sir William McPherson's definition, which is extremely broad, intentionally broad, because obviously in the context of Stephen Lawrence's murder and everything that happened subsequently after, clearly it is something that exists. Now, there are some people who argue that that definition might not be very fit for purpose 20, 30 years after that report was published. I find it to be an interesting debate to be had. But nonetheless, we live in a society where, you know, Damon Lewis Casey's review into the Metropolitan Police last year said it was institutionally racist, sexist, homophobic, everything you can think of, right?
Pretty much everything.
And so that begs the question. If you give an organization or institution a label and 2-3 decades ago, and it still has the label, and some people might argue that actually it's worse, some people might argue that it's better, then therefore how valuable, how productive has it been?
Yeah.
And if you are in a situation to give the label, and then if you're in a situation now when London's less safe, police officers are literally not investigating crimes, and this is not my opinion, this is fact, right?
Yeah.
So then it begs the question, have we approached the situation that we find ourselves in the best possible way to get the best possible outcome? And I don't actually think it's just in the context of the Met. Because, you know, you can go to many corporate environments where people can say, well, we published a report, or we hired a consultant. The consultant made these recommendations. The consultant said that we had this, that, that, that as an issue. And we are just not making any progress. In fact, things feel worse. And so my view is that I think there is a lot of focus on understanding the makeup of society from maybe a sociological perspective, really articulating what moment we're in and what labels need to be attributed to that moment. But actually, to make the most impact, you have to focus more on the psychology of human beings, how we are wired, and how that has an impact on our own individual behaviors. And so, for example, when somebody is explicitly racist, that is a manifestation of what is inside of them. What is inside is what is coming out. And so the question is, what is inside? Is it hate? Is it fear? Is it both? And what is the root cause of that? Is it a lack of education? Is it a lack of interaction with people that are different? Is it the fear of the unknown, or the fear of being replaced, etc.? And how do you counter that? Or is it ignorance? Very often it is ignorance, you know? And so for me, I think there's probably been too much focus on the sociology of race and racism, and not enough focus on the psychology of human behavior. And I think that is probably how we get better results. And so, for example, if you told a child that a child is useless, a child is stupid, a child can't do anything right, then that child is going to grow up and very likely respond in a way that is not necessarily ideal. And so if you tell an institution that it's this and it's that, how then do you expect it to do better and improve? Maybe you should. You have to confront uncomfortable truths. But I would reckon that you could probably get more mileage out of perhaps finding ways for us to live more productively with each other. And maybe perhaps being more understanding, having more safe spaces. You mentioned multicultural networks and their value early on in our conversation. And I would argue that...
Or lack of.
And I would argue that actually more important than a multicultural network is a commitment to people from different backgrounds building meaningful relationships with each other.
Yes.
In any institution.
Yeah.
And actually that for me is a much more interesting... an important challenge.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. It's kind of like, how, I know it sounds trite, but how can we all live and work together, right? How can we create a much more inclusive, I know your business can be inclusive boards, but an inclusive organisation? How can we do that? And, you know, sometimes when I debate, you know, should we have people on boards and stuff, I'm like, that isn't the question. The question is, how can we create an environment and a culture where everyone feels like they can belong? Because belonging actually isn't necessarily being in an all-black room. It's about a sense of feeling respected and a sense of fairness, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the organisations that we want people to create.
Yeah, and there's a sense of... I suppose there needs to be a grading of how inclusive an organisation is. And part of that, very high on that grading, should be the ability to live side by side with people that you might not even agree with on many things. And having that level of trust to be able to have uncomfortable conversations, but recognizing that those conversations at their very best are two ways.
Yeah.
And I think in the world of diversity inclusion right now, we've gotten to a point where actually the conversations are mainly one way. And so we've gone from having no conversation and that being a source of great tension that, you know, nobody wants to talk about X, Y, and Z experiences, to now saying, well, actually, you must align yourself with a particular worldview or you're not in a good place.
Yeah.
And so what then happens is, in some organizations, is there is a combustion. And so, I don't know, white male who feels like he's never going to be promoted, all of a sudden feels very resentful when a black woman is promoted, and they think it must only be because of the color of their skin. Or you've told the Metropolitan Police many times that they're crap, and all of a sudden they really are crap, right? Yeah, yeah. And so we've got to this stage where it's very one-dimensional. And so we need to, I guess, push on to that next phase, which is how we can mix socially in a way that allows us to feel like we can all have our concerns addressed. But more important than that, we can feel that there's a relationship where those relationships then exist.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's about culture and relationships, not necessarily numbers and quotas,
mm-hmm.
right? That everyone, and fairness.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, and transparency is, yeah. of course, part of that. You know, when you don't have trust, then the best thing you can do initially is have transparency. When you have a recruitment process, how do you make sure it's transparent? How do you make sure there's a diverse panel of individuals who are scoring and are doing the interviews? How do you make sure that you've promoted it as far and as wide as possible? How do you make sure that you give really good feedback? So where you don't have the trust yet, you can start with transparency.
Yep.
But trust must be the ultimate objective.
100%. And actually, trust and belonging. And belonging isn't about there's 50% or 40% or 30%. It's about people feel that you can get on here and it's
mm-hmm.
fair
mm-hmm.
and transparent, and that people aren't held back because of the colour of their skin or their gender or whether they're disabled or not. That's not what happens here. And it's
mm-hmm.
that's a cultural thing. So how can we build in society and in businesses cultures that feel like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, it's that, and transparency helps. Targets maybe help, but it's the culture that's the key.
Yeah, and also every context is different. And so when I was in Downing Street, there was a huge focus on whether or not we should bring in ethnicity pay gap reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge we had was that ethnicity pay reporting could work in maybe a place like London,
mm-hmm.
you know, where about half the population are Black and Asian. About a third, we're not even born in the UK, you know, proper metropolitan city. And so there's rich enough data to be able to crunch and analyze and make some really interesting analysis. But then in a place like, I don't know, Bishop Auckland or Shropshire, you know, how useful would ethnicity pay reporting be? And actually, there are some challenges around, well, would that encourage good or bad behaviors? So, for example, if the only Black person in the organization is someone that's quite lower down, you know, what happens to that person's experience? Or if the only Asian person is I don't know, your chief information officer,
the very senior, then it's the same problem.
What does that do to your data? And then how does that influence your behaviors? Will you behave in a way that is fair based on the data that you've been mandated to produce that might not necessarily paint the fullest picture? And so for us, there were interesting nuances and challenges. And so in some contexts, data is very useful, or more data is useful. In other contexts, actually, behaviors is probably a stronger pull towards fairness. And so, you know, there are huge challenges we have, but I think behaviors, as you mentioned, and culture are things that can drive change quicker.
Yeah. And embed change. Numbers and targets and stuff can change all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look, this has been great. Just to bring it all together, I ask all my guests, because when we do this section, people always talk, it always feels a little bit negative. Well, not hasn't today, but can do, about race and institutional racism and things like that. So I always like to finish on something that's hopeful. So what gives you hope? Why should we be hopeful that we can make the required changes that we need to?
I think we can be hopeful because I think the future generations won't have the same issues that we have, because they are much more passionate about equality and much more uncomfortable about injustice.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that can give us all hope. I caveat that with the fact that we have never been in the moment that we are in now. Britain has never looked the way it looks. Right. Social upward mobility has never been the way it is. You know, record numbers of people going to university, and that's a question and a debate for another time. but nonetheless, we are constantly evolving. And so the challenges will always change. And how we respond to that will need to be adapted, and I suppose in the not too distant future, the other thing that is going to add to the dynamics that we are grappling with now is the use of AI and technology. Because you know, some jobs are just not going to exist. So whether you're black or white, you know, you're just not going to be able to do it, because, you know, unfortunately some robots will replace those work, or fortunately, depending on who you're talking to. And so that will bring with it even more challenges. So I think, yeah, a few generations give me hope, but the nature of the challenges will always just evolve.
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting point. And someone always said to me, you know, we'll all get on when we are being attacked by aliens, right? Because aliens will be different and we'll all be the same, humans.
Well, yeah.
You know, the thing we're trying to say, everyone, we're all just humans, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you don't get that until you have something else that's not human. And maybe AI is that thing. Maybe artificial intelligence is that thing that's not human.
Yeah.
You know, that we can all come together.
Well, I mean, I don't know who I was talking to the other day. I said, there will come a time when robots no longer have need for us.
Yeah.
And that's what should focus minds.
I know, yeah. Let's focus on that altogether as humans.
Yeah.
You know, rather than different shades of human.
Yeah.
You know. Brilliant. Well, look, thank you. It's been a fascinating conversation. You very unique in your experiences and what you've been exposed to. And that thing has really come through in the stuff that we've discussed. So I'd like to thank you for giving me the time to discuss this stuff with you, and for being so open. It's been a really great conversation and very inspirational. I'm sure people who listen to it will find it such. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.